Jason, we friends just having a conversation.
Wave your hands high.
Don't stop.
Wave your hands high.
Don't stop.
All right, welcome back to North Texas Music Fanatics. I'm Jason Janik. This is such a low-key show. I can't even remember if I've introduced myself in the last couple episodes. So in case you weren't aware, I'm Jason. It's basically a show where we take North Texas musicians and we chat. It's just two friends talking. A few of you have been asking about that little song snippet that we're using at the intro. I want to let you know that is the wonderful PPT we had Picasso on the first episode. That's from their Denglish album, the one that I did the photography for. Definitely see if you can find a copy of that, because that's amazing. So, we've got somebody I've known for a little while now. He goes by Johnny Lloyd Rollins.
Hello, hello.
And I think what we'll do is... find out a little bit more about him. Let me ask you this. We'll just start off right away.
Yeah.
When did you first realize that you were, or that you were becoming Johnny Lloyd Rollins?
Probably, well, right before I moved back to Texas, originally from California, I've lived in Northern California, Southern California, moved to Texas when I was a senior in high school, moved back to California, and then came back here. So right when I was back, here is when I started. I was kind of just playing the songs that my bands thought were kind of goofy, that my bands in California and in Los Angeles that were like, you know, we tried to be serious rock and roll bands that were like, we were very Smashing Pumpkins-esque grunge.
That's right. Over dinner, we were chatting for a little bit, and you said that you were in quite a few bands there in California.
Yeah.
And you had built up some material that I guess just didn't fit in with them. How was it in California? What was that like? This is a Texas-centered show, but let's hear the history.
That was back in the late 90s, so this is kind of still very early internet era. You know, it was basically the era of, you know, taking your CD to, like, a burned CD or a mixtape that you made to every club, and you just went and knocked on doors, and you literally would go down Sunset Strip and knock on a club, drop off your band bio and your band picture and your CD and hope that you could get a gig. And then you just try to follow up with them every few weeks to see if you could get a slot, which funnily enough, I got to open for some interesting acts. I opened for Nikki Sixx. That was interesting. And
that would have been fun.
Yeah. It was a very, kind of that when, that metalhead, like hair metal scene was already way gone. I mean, we're talking late 90s and grunge was already gone by then too, so it's like it was a very odd show opening for that. And my band was at the time was very much a Britpop Oasis ripoff style band, which is they're like one of my favorite bands, so it was like that was, you know, our influences at the time. But it was like songs that were like that I ended up becoming popular with here when people started noticing it, like on MySpace. It was like MySpace era, you know, even that sounds like ancient now. It's like that's when you and I had known each other from that era, almost from that time
frame.
It's
like, so we first met through Quick. I was doing all the cover photography and feature photography for them, and I remember you coming in for a Halloween feature.
Yep.
And everyone was dressing up as somebody who kind of influenced them or they adored, and you came in as Elvis.
Yeah.
So I still remember that. And Sarah Jaffe we did as Willie Nelson, which was a blast. And
well, it's funny about that because people just assume that I'm an Elvis fan, and I am, but not in the same way that, like, I'll give you an example. Like, I went as a lark. Somebody said you should go to this Elvis karaoke contest, and this was literally like this last summer. And side note, I was a project manager for a short time. This last summer? Man, I can't even think. It was like a year ago. Not this last summer, the summer before last. I was doing project management for Dave & Buster's and running a venue for them in Dallas. And we were doing a lot of karaoke stuff. And so that's where someone came and said, oh, you sound like Elvis. You should go do an Elvis thing. So I was like, okay, sure. Just for fun, because I do like Elvis a lot. So I go to this restaurant, and it was like they'd been doing this karaoke contest for like 50 years. And the place was packed. I mean, I got more marriage proposals from 80-year-old women ever, and more drinks than ever. Like, and there were fat Elvises, skinny Elvises, Elvises with braces, baby Elvises. And I just showed up like, you know, wearing my regular clothes, like, you know, black on black. I was like, I'm Danny Zuko. I'm not Elvis. So, of course, I'm like, I'll enter the contest just for fun. And then I get last, which is the worst position to get in a karaoke contest because everybody's singing all the songs that you want to pick. So that was a painful thing. But I'd never seen, I never witnessed Elvis fans like in person where they're like hardcore fans. And these women, even men, there were people just crying, like literally streaming tears and how much they loved Elvis. And that was an experience. I'd never seen anything like that for any artist. I
grew up with an Elvis fan. My father adored him.
Yeah.
Him and Fabian.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I understand. Get it. There's definitely a little bit of craziness still around Elvis.
And the only reason I got into Elvis was because I was playing, when I first started playing as my own stuff, I was just playing my own stuff. And it went from coffee shops to restaurants. Well, restaurants need you to play for like 3 or 4 hours. They're like, you got to play all night. So I'm like, well, what can I play that I can learn? I mean, I got booked at a gig and I had to go play in a week. So I'm like, well, what can I learn in a week that I don't have to think that's easy to do? And I was like, oh, I can probably pull off, you know, 68 comeback style Elvis just with an acoustic guitar. And so I just went and like picked out like 20 songs. And then a bunch of Buddy Holly tunes that were like, you know, most of them are three chords. So it's
exactly.
Once you figure out the changes, I was like, oh, okay, cool. I can pull this off. And then I realized, oh, I kind of really like Elvis. Like these songs are really fun to play and sing. And that's how I got into it. And so like you and I were having our discussion of what era of Elvis. And I'm like, I'm very much an early Elvis. I don't like army or movie Elvis. I mean, it's okay, but I don't dig on it. And then 68 Comeback Special is like my all-time favorite. And then I dig on some of the Fat Elvis era too, but really 68 Comeback Special is like my favorite Elvis.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that, that's for sure.
Yeah.
However, you say the all black leather Elvis.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I've seen you, because we both spent a lot of time in McKinney.
Yes.
I saw you in the McKinney Christmas parade as Fat Hoverboard Elvis.
Yeah.
And that was fun to watch.
So there's a story behind that. So there's a lady who owns the building next door here next to me. It's kind of empty now, but they run, it's called Bear Market, but they also run a costume and a movie prop warehouse that's right off of Highway 5. We're talking big warehouses and movie props of stuff that is so bizarre that it would boggle your mind. And she would always have Elvis, so they would do Christmas on our, because we do a big downtown holiday, you know, festival down here in Christmas time. And so they would do Christmas pictures with Santa. And on our street, we said, we're going to do Christmas pictures with Elvis. So that I got nominated to be Elvis. And then she put together a whole Christmas red outfit for me for Elvis. And then during the parade for 4th of July, I go to her and she put together a whole, you know, it's basically an Evel Knievel outfit, but then you just make it look like Elvis. You put some glasses on.
Right.
And then, it's Elvis.
Yeah.
And so I would be in the parade and I ride my one wheel around on the parade as flying Elvis, throwing gold coins at people, you know.
People definitely enjoyed it. Well, let's get back to what we were talking about a minute ago. So you had moved from California. You moved over here to Dallas.
Yep.
You had started to perform and record that stuff that you said just didn't have a place in your previous bands.
Yes.
You started recording as a solo artist.
Yep.
We met, what do you think it was? Maybe like 2008-ish?
Yeah, maybe even earlier, like 2007, 2008. Yeah, right around that time.
And so by then, like you had said, you know, this was still MySpace era.
Yep.
And you were starting to get some real traction off of that.
Yeah.
So talk to me, I mean, how do you go from, you know, moving to a new city, which I'm sure you didn't really know a bunch
anybody.
Of musicians. Anybody. Okay. So how do you go from not knowing anybody to where you are now?
Well, that's what was interesting about the MySpace era is, and people make memes about it now, it's like, you wanted to go meet people. So that was the whole point. Nowadays, it's like you block everybody and you don't want anybody to know anything about you. But back then, everyone was like, oh, let's become friends. You're into that band? Oh, so am I. Let's go hang out. So it was very easy in that 2005-ish to 2008-ish period to literally, there were so many little pocket scenes in Dallas at the time. And everybody kind of just knew each other. So I would literally bounce from scene to scene and I'd go over, oh, here I'm hanging with the Mod Kids. And then I'd go over to like, whatever, what was the metal club at the time? Was it Clearview or something? Where was all the metal shows?
It was at Curtain Club.
Yeah, Curtain
and
Club.
Galaxy had punk and heavy metal.
And you go to like the Red Blood Club or whatever. And then you go play. I literally would open for a metal band at Trees. So anybody, I would just be playing with my acoustic guitar and no one cared because I was playing kind of like Beatlesque mixed with Elvis-y type tunes, and that was just my style. And people were like, oh, that's different. Well, yeah, you can open for us. Yeah, sure, why not? And so that was really endearing because I came from an area in Southern California. I mean, other than the LA scene, which is very different. Like, everyone's an actor, model, and musician in LA. So it's like nobody's caring about what you're doing on stage. They're just waiting to get on stage next. So it's kind of like a city full of open mic. Like, everybody's there to get on stage next. Whereas here, it was like, oh, everybody's kind of friends, and people hang out with each other, and they are all musicians, but they're genuinely trying to, like, hang out and listen to what you're doing and supporting each other. And that wasn't the same thing in LA. Everyone's like, the only reason they're becoming friends with you is so they can get, you know, in on some club or whatever. And so that was very different vibe when I moved here. And then it was just the fact that my stuff just started getting popular. It was kind of a lark. Like, I literally just played, I said, I'm just going to go play these songs for fun and not intending anything to happen from it. But it literally just kind of escalated year over year. It went from like I said, it was like coffee shops, then restaurants, then clubs. And when I got to the club level, it was like, oh, then other musicians that were in all these other bands started saying, hey, I want to play with you. Or I would talk to other musicians, say, hey, I need a bass player or whatever. And so there was a lot of, I had a core group of musicians that I would play with a lot. And then there were some people that just rotate in and out over the years. But then it went to festivals. And then from festivals, and it was got to tour England. And then I got to be on BBC Radio, got to play Cavern Club. And that was just like, that alone was like, okay, this is great. Like,
that would be a blast.
Yeah.
Well, let's do this because I want to kick into when you start recording, but we should play a song first.
Okay.
And it would make sense to play something related to Elvis since we just talked about that, but it's a Texas-based show, so we're not going to play Elvis. We are going to play an old song by Meredith Miller. It's called Dreams About You and Elvis. I think that'll be a fun one to start with.
Perfect.
I keep having dreams about you and Elvis. And Elvis wants me back, but you don't. I guess I'll get together with Elvis. At least I won't have to sleep alone. What you get is rarely what you ask for. I wanted you at the King of Rock and Roll. My love for you was somehow misdirected. At least I won't have to sleep alone. There's a hole in my pillow where you used to sleep. A hole in my heart where yours used to live. And a hole in the wall I punched out when you left me. I want you back in my arms again. Sorry, darling, but the king dreams with me now. Started when you didn't call me back. I went to sleep mad and Elvis took over. But if you ask me real nice, I just might take you back. What you get is rarely what you ask for. Wanted you, I got the king of rock and roll. My love for you was somehow misdirected. Oh, at least I won't have to sleep alone. There's a hole in my pillow where you used to sleep.
about you and Elvis. And Elvis wants me back, but you don't. I guess I'll get together with Elvis. At least I won't have to sleep alone. At least I won't have to sleep alone.
All right, well, that was a fun one.
And we're back.
So, like I said, I think it makes sense now to discuss how did you go from making yourself known here in Dallas, playing live, meeting musicians, into recording something. Tell me, when did that happen?
So, I first, right before I came out here, moved back out here, I recorded a 3-song demo of the song that most people know me for, which is Let's Be Poor Together, done on like, it wasn't even a, it was, remember those little digital track things that came out? And I can't remember who made them, but they were really popular for like a good 5 years. And they were like those little digital recorders, little mixer and everything. And it was, that's what people used to record as their home studio for a while, pre-Pro Tools era.
Yeah,
so it was like before Pro Tools hit.
So like a little Tascam, like a...
Yeah, but it was... I can't
but
remember.
It was digital, so it wasn't like a 4-2-4.
Uh-uh.
Okay.
So it had like 8 tracks on it, and I'm sure we can Google it later and remember what the name was, but it was super popular. Everyone had one of those. And so I had one, and I had a buddy that just helped me record it, and we just did it. Literally, it was me and a basic electric guitar. It wasn't even acoustic. And so then I put those songs on MySpace, and it just really started getting steam. Like when I moved out here and started knowing people, but it just in general, everyone was on MySpace looking for artists. And so for a short period of time, for like a year or two, I was one of the top 10 artists on MySpace, solo artists on MySpace. And then that's when I had record labels coming out and coming to meet me and talk to me about stuff. And then I would fly back and forth from New York to LA doing showcases all the time. Then that was just, I was playing shows just a lot back and forth. And then that's when I started putting together a band. And a lot of those labels were like, well, you should go do an album and see what you can do with an album. And that's when I recorded with Salim Nirala, because he was like the guy at the time. And he still is the guy. I mean, he's a great producer and engineer.
I worked with him on Rhett Miller's, one of his solo albums.
Yep.
And it was beautiful to watch Salim work, because he basically opens himself up to everything.
Yes. Any idea?
Yeah.
Let's try this. Okay.
It's gorgeous.
Yes.
It's great to watch, because some of the stuff that comes out of it, you're like, I mean, that sound shouldn't have happened, but it's because he's willing to experiment the way that some aren't.
Yep. In fact, that's funny you mentioned that, because I was hanging out at the studio at the time that Rhett was hanging out there too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then that was on Verve, and Verve was one of the record labels that I went and met with a lot. They were like close to signing with me. But then you mentioned, well, that's when the record industry all collapsed, with 2008 and 2009. So pretty much everybody that I knew at labels was all gone. They all got lost their jobs because the labels didn't exist anymore. But I did record that album with Salim. It was really fun. And actually his main engineer, Rip Rowan, who's also a genius, was kind of the main producer on that record. Salim kind of just oversaw everything and helped do certain things, but Rip was like there on the day to day with me. I mean, that guy's really, really, people don't know a lot about him unless you knew him and were here at the time when he lived here, and he doesn't live here now anymore. But that guy, he used to run Pro Rec magazine, which was a huge recording engineer magazine. He was the founder of that magazine. He wrote the famous article about the noise wars back when CD mastering and compression was like just horrible. And he wrote a famous article that everybody in the industry knew. That article was about, and he was talking about the new Rush album that was just mastered and compressed.
Well, and Metallica getting trashed for it. Yeah.
So he wrote this really popular article, and that I knew who he was. Like, I didn't know that it was him, but I knew I had read that article. And so when I met him, I was like, you're that guy. I'm like, yes, I can't wait to work with you. And I was like, really, really just a magical, fun experience recording that record. And at the same time, there was a lot of press, obviously, that were saying I was Elvis meets Paul McCartney. That was like the shtick. So I was like, okay.
Well, I mean, I can listen to your stuff and I hear a little bit of a Chris Isaacs, which is,
you know,
an offshoot of Elvis.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a line that can be drawn, but clearly I can listen to you and I'm not listening to somebody who's trying to ape off Elvis.
That. Correct. Yeah. Like, that just was, it was... It factored into some of my songwriting, but then all my songs have some element of somewhere else. It's just like any songwriter, but it's like Harry Nilsson's one of my biggest influences, or, you know, Steeler's Wheel is one of my favorite bands. And at the time, right before I started recording it, my demos were getting played on radio, college radio, like big time, like all over college radio stations. And then these college DJs were sending me this guy named Emmett Rhodes. And I was like, who the hell is this guy? And they're like, you're the new Emmett Rhodes. And I was like, I have no idea who that is. So then I put on the records. People sent me his records. And I was like, oh, this guy is like literally like sounds just like me, writes like me, sings like me, which is really creepy. It was like, did my mom have an affair with some guy? Like, because it was like his stuff came out in the early 70s. I'm like, dude, this is creepy weird. Even some of the songs were written very similarly. And it's just because he's a Beatle ahead guy.
Well, and I mean, I'm sure, are we talking similar age here?
At the time, yeah.
Yeah, you're probably looking at somebody who had similar influences.
Yes, 100%.
You know, it's...
It just, he probably followed the same pathway of, yeah, of songwriting style that I did. And so it was just funny listening to it, though. It was like, some of the songs were like very close in sound, and I was like, wow, that's funny. He became one of my all-time favorite artists ever. I mean, I became obsessed. And at the time, you couldn't get his records. Like, so people were sending me CDs, and like, and there was this one website that talked about him. And now everybody kind of knows who Emmett Rhodes is in the terms of like, if you're an indie musician or pop musician, you're like, most people know.
Yeah, I know the name. I don't know that I've really listened to his stuff close, but I definitely know the name.
It's a familiar name, but back in that time, it wasn't. Even like probably what I was trying to do with that record was, I mean, it was kind of a Americana Texas spin, but really it was me doing an American version of Britpop music. That's essentially what I am as an artist, is like most of my songs are that. And
well, that was kind of heavy here in Dallas anyways, because I mean, you had people like Chomsky who,
yes,
who adore, I mean, you know, Glenn loves Oasis, XTC, yep, stuff like that. There was definitely heavy respect in Dallas for that music.
Yes, and more so, it was funny only because, well, you're also a big Blur fan, so you and I share, yes, that. I'm a huge, huge Blur fan.
So I got into Blur. Do you remember Chris Wheat? I think he's in New York now, but he was a musician here in Dallas. And I got into Blur because of him. Yeah.
I mean, my youthfulness endears me towards Oasis, but my maturity endears me towards Blur, just because they're a better band. I mean,
musically, yeah, no doubt.
Far and far. But Oasis had the heart of a classic rock and roll band, which is like, they very much were like, at the first record and all the B-sides is what got me into music. That's what got me into songwriting, was, oh, there's a band that like, their B-sides are better than their album tracks, and they have like 20 singles that everyone has like 5 B-sides on it. It's like, holy cow, you can explore this forever, and there's so many great songs. I never thought they were like the Beatles at all. It was just like, oh, this is a great rock and roll band. They were more like the Sex Pistols.
So I always thought of them more like the Who.
Yeah, they're like just a loud, brash band, and that's what they were. They weren't trying to be like Blur. It was like, Blur's a, and to their credit, Blur actually doesn't get a lot. They're like, nobody knows Blur in the United States. So they're always just the
Except
Woohoo
for song
band.
Number 2.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. They're the Woohoo band. And it's like, and then you go, oh, the Gorillaz. And like, oh, yeah, I like the Gorillaz. Like, this boggles my mind that they weren't as big, but we could talk about Britpop all day. I mean, I'm a really,
let's talk
really
more
hard
about Texas.
Yeah, let's talk about Texas, because I'm a very heavy Britpop fan. But Texas, so
who
anyway.
Who all recorded on your album with you?
At the time, so John McIntyre, who played with Record Hop, was like my drummer at the time. John Solis was also my drummer for a long, long time, and he still plays with me every now and then. He toured with me when I toured England, but then when I came back, right before I went on my second tour of England, that's when I got John McIntyre, and I was a big Record Hop fan.
You're listing great names so far.
Yeah, yeah. Record Hop was like, hands down, Ashley is like one of my favorite
singers.
Yeah,
we're actually going to do an episode with Ashley coming up here. We'll take a quick second to note. I'm pretty sure that next week is going to be Gary Wiseman with Bowling for Soup, and then we're going to have a string of just wonderfully talented women, and Ashley will be in there. She might be like episode 6-ish. We'll see how it plays out.
I remember seeing them for the first time. That's what's funny about Dallas. Like, I would be playing my Beatlesque pop tunes on an acoustic guitar, and then Record Hop would go on next. That's how crazy it was back in the day when all Deep Ellum was totally a club and a venue scene, and that's not that anymore. It's like a foodie, touristy hangout place. But it was so fun getting to play like Dada and opening for a band like Record Hop. I mean, like, I would sit there and I'm like, they're playing like, what was the song? It was like The Grassy Knoll or something. Like, I took a shot on The Grassy Knoll or something crazy. And I'm like, this band is so great. And they were so friendly. And Ashley was just always like super endearing. And that's classic, that era. So then I had Joey McClellan played lead on that record, who's now in Midlake and also plays with El King. I'm actually attending his brother's wedding in a couple days and a few more days, and all the wedding is, the whole wedding party is all people that have played with me in my band at some point. So it's kind of, we're doing a little reunion show.
That's how it works though.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's so funny. Like, and then then Eric Swanson, who plays with Israel Nash. So he played bass on that. And that was the core band for a long time. And then Joey left to New York, and a lot of those guys all moved to New York, but they all came back eventually. Everyone comes back to Texas. They all leave, but they all come back. And then Chris Holt was my guitar player for a very long time, for a number of years, and toured with me. And he's great, and everyone knows Chris Holt. Hi, Chris. So other than that, I mean, that was the core band. And so then we started touring more and played that record, and I sold a lot of CDs, kind of like out of the back of my truck, you know. And then I toured with a band called South. They had me as their opener, and that was a really fun tour. I got to, I'd been all over. I've been in other countries, and I've been in a fair amount of states in the United States, but that was like the first time I'd ever really toured the United States, and that was a great experience. I got to be the driver of the bus, so I got paid for that. I got to be the open act, so I got paid for that. Worked the merch table, so I made money off of that. I was the only person making in the black on that tour because I was just like making money hand over fist. That was a fun tour. And it was just, I never understand when bands complain about being on tour. Like, never. I always have loved touring.
Yeah, but everything I've known about you, you understand the business side of things.
Yes.
And so many musicians don't.
No.
So I think that is probably a key factor.
Yeah. No, I was like, I went into so much debt when I started doing my second record, which I still haven't released, sitting on a shelf for 10 years. Cause like I ran out of money. I mean, you literally, and back then you still, home studios were still kind of a new thing. Even in 2010, it's like, I mean, just to get Pro Tools, that cost a crap ton of money, and all the plugins that you would need and all the things and the gear you would still need to really make a really quality record. And you know, you can make it on your own. You can do it yourself. It's like, yes, you can. And there's a truth to that to some extent. It still helps to have a really high quality production.
Yeah, I mean, if you're doing like a Sex Pistols thing, or if you're doing like a lo-fi Pavement thing,
yeah,
sure. But
sure, but
otherwise,
even then,
it has to sound.
But even then, those records are still produced really well. So it's like, yeah, you can do bedroom recording. It all depends on the song. There's like the song, the production, who sings it, and the arrangement. It's like those are the four components. Yeah, so it's like production is in there, but it's like it's not the top thing, but it should be near the top. But the song is the top.
Are you into Super Drag at all?
Oh yeah, love Super Drag. So I went. That was the one show the first show I ever saw in Dallas was Super Drag and Not a Surf, and who else was on that bill? It was Not a Surf and Super Drag, and I think it was an outdoor patio. I can't remember what venue this was. This is like 97.
Oh wow, yeah.
And man, that was a great show.
I photographed them in concert several times because I adore them. But the reason I bring it up is because their albums are produced
so spot on. Yeah, yeah.
But did you ever hear their 8-track demos?
Yeah.
I don't know if you ever heard that album, but I mean, it exemplifies what you're talking about. Where I mean, it's just such a night and day difference.
Yeah, and you can hear the if you're a songwriter. Like even with Blur demos, the same thing. Like you can hear where they're going with it. But production is really hard thing, because I'll give you an example, like using Blur. So Blur recorded Modern Life is Rubbish, which is one of my favorite records, with Andy Partridge of XTC. And the Andrew Partridge mixes and the versions of those songs are okay, but then you hear Stephen Street's versions and you're like, oh, okay, there's a reason Stephen Street. And he's just I don't want to say better, but he's a totally different style producer that fit that band and the sound that they were trying to accomplish. And it's funny only because if you know Blur, they're huge XTC fans too. So you can hear elements of that band in Blur, but that wasn't the right person. It's same as my first record. Salim was the right person at the right time for me at that moment.
Let's hear what you and Salim accomplished together. We're going to play a song off that album right now.
Yeah.
Right, so let's kick into, I guess, your next phase.
We're
now, I'm guessing, around 2010 to 2020 era.
Yep. So,
and I remember seeing, because I remember, I guess it was probably 2010. I remember running into you playing at, I think it was the Nilo Hotel.
Yeah.
I mean, you still did a lot of solo gigs, right?
Yeah. So. And that was kind of like at the same frame that I was really exiting, getting a little bit burnt out between that 2010 and 2012 phase, because I was working on that a new record. I was recording at Tom Bridwell's studio, and we got the majority of the record done in like 3 days. But then it went into like mixing hell. So it was like mixing for like 2 years. And so, I mean, talking about bankruptcy, it's like, dude, I went into so much debt. Like if I said the number, people would be like, oh my God, like beyond student loan debt, like big, a lot of money. And it was like, that's just because I was trying not necessarily to make it perfect. I just wanted it to be right. Sometimes it depends on who's mixing, and people don't realize how important mixing is. And then I was doing a lot of corporate gigs. You saw me at Nilo. I was good friends with Mike Mueller, who owned Nilo Hotels at the time. And so he had me open. Anytime he opened a new Nilo Hotel, he would book my band because he was just a fan of my band.
Yeah. And they did some great stuff. We're not here to discuss hotels. We're here to discuss music.
But that was a cool concept of a hotel.
It was. So I did the main artwork for the entryway of the one here in Frisco.
Yep.
And then they hired me and commissioned me to do one up in Warwick, Rhode Island. And it was fun. I loved it.
Yep.
I know that they've since, because this has been like 10 years, and they changed out the artwork. So you won't see my stuff here in Dallas anymore.
Yeah.
I have no clue. I heard the one at Warwick flooded. So who knows about that? But I enjoyed it. And I got a kick out of seeing you playing.
Yeah. So I just did corporate gigs for a while. And it was like, I just got tired of like, you know, the only reason I'm doing this is for money. And it was like, that wasn't why I got into it. I really, like I said, I kind of did it as a lark. It was just kind of like, oh, I'm going to go play these songs that I still wanted to be a musician. I still am a musician. It was like at the time when I started playing Dallas, it was just like, I'm just going to go have fun. And then it ballooned into bigger and bigger and bigger, into where I can see why people, they get really big. They're like, oh, they feel this, like they have to go do this in order to support this machine they've created. And I was trying to finish this other record, and I was going to debt, and I'm like, dude, I can't do this anymore. And it also snowballed and segued into me buying the candy store that I bought Mom and Popcorn at the same time. It was all at the exact same time at that moment.
Oh yeah. Cause I remember again, I mean, we've run into each other so many times at random places.
Yeah.
I remember seeing you, you know, doing your popcorn thing at one of the festivals.
Yep. Yeah. So I got into that, and that was only because the owner at the time, this store had been around for like 5-6 years, and she was a big fan. Her and her husband used to come to all my shows, like all of them. And they would play my music in their store and stuff like that. Then she had this place above the store that was, she said, if you renovate it, I'll lease it out to you. I said, great. So I did that. And then a year later, she was ready to sell her business. And so I was, at the time, perfect timing, bought it on a note from her, and then paid off that note, fixed her business and turned it into a functioning business, paid it off in 2 years. So then I was like out at every single elementary school and doing stuff for kids all over the DFW. So the little kids would see me at gas stations and be like, hey, Mr. Popcorn Man. And the parents are like, who's this guy talking to my kid? And they're like, oh, you're that guy who made me sell like 30 bags of popcorn. So yeah. And then I was just helping out. Like I would go to I got my popcorn as the official popcorn or Granada Theater for a short period of time. That was fun. So all the events would have my popcorn. And so I just had fun doing that. And it was entertaining. Like it was like when I learned how to surf, I stopped doing music in LA right before I came to Texas because I had learned how to surf and I had gotten tired of my bands at the time. And all I did was surf for 2 years. And that was like, that filled the void. That candy store filled the void for a short period of time, for a good 5-6 years of me not being in the music scene. And you know, McKinney now, it's like McKinney, everyone would be like, oh, come to Dallas, come to this thing. And I'm like, no, I have, you come up here, come check out this little town. It's like this little cool touristy, it's like going back in time to It's a Wonderful Life with like Jimmy Stewart and like Back to the Future. It's like, that's literally, you walk around here and it's like that. And now it's become a really like place to come hang out. Like people all come here all the time now. So I didn't need to go out and do stuff and go see stuff, what's going on in Dallas, unless I was going to go see a show or something like that. But yeah, I was just kind of in my own little world up here for a long time. And I sat on that record that I never finished. It always was, has been bugging me, and I just never had the money to finish it. And so now it's like, I can finally, I'm like pretty much out of debt, and I could afford to go back into a studio. So I went back into Elmwood with Alex. My stuff was very different than what he normally mixes and produces.
Yeah. 100%.
And so, but that was fun for him. So we had fun together, and he and I get along really, really well. And
well, so did you notice, did he bring anything in? Cause I mean, I can imagine maybe he added a little bit of a harder edge.
Not necessarily a harder edge, but he was open to, he understood that I understood production, and that I wasn't like, when I came to him with an idea, I had a very clear vision, and he would adapt to that very easily. And he could also say, well, what if we tried this? And he liked that I was open to trying any idea. It was just a very good companionship, to where we were both open to each other's ideas. And if it worked, great. If it didn't, it didn't work. And he's very much a on your like quick on your feet type of person. Like, oh, okay, let me go do this. I mean, let me go mess around with this really quick and see if this works.
I think it's in his bones. Though.
Yeah.
He's got the lineage behind him of production.
Yes. So. And I actually worked at that studio for a short period of time in between the years with, what was the guy before him that ran Elmwood? That left, Stuart Sykes. So Stuart Sykes worked on one or two songs with me at Elmwood. And then I worked with Bo Bedford for a long time. And that was pre like Texas Gentleman era. So okay. They had a house in like Southeast Dallas area. And it was like where all the Texas Gentleman guys hung out. They all lived in this weird mansion. And if people know this, they know this, but it was just funny. It was like pure, it was like classic. It was almost like you walked into the 60s. Like, it was so cool going into their house, and Bo was living there with all these guys, and it was just like a hippie house. It was like you literally walked back in time, a little, really cool little element.
Dallas had that in the 80s with the Loco Gringos. And
they were all kind of in different bands at the time, but then they all started, you could see everybody was like Jonathan Tyler guy. All those guys were all living together, and that's what, they have their own pocket of a scene that's very interesting. But yeah, I recorded with Bo for a long time. But I'm a huge, huge, huge folk 50s, 60s era folk fan. Like, Pete Seeger's probably my all-time favorite artist, hands down. Like, another person, the reason why I became a musician was because I saw a Pete Seeger documentary and I was like 12 years old. And I was like, oh my God, that guy's amazing.
Oh yeah, he's done everything. And the stuff that he's done for the roots of music, way that he's gone to Africa and shine a spotlight. And so this is where all the stuff that you guys are playing now, this is where this all came from. And it's just nice to know there was a champion like him.
Yes. And so that was a, that's why I didn't really dig on the folk music of the 2010s, because it was so, it didn't really say anything. It wasn't anything that I felt was, it had a good sound, it sounded real, but it didn't have the same emotiveness or messaging that back in the day, people in the 50s.
It felt like one of those chocolate Easter bunnies where it looks nice on the outside.
Yeah,
but
it was just hollow. Yeah. It was just, you know, I'm not to knock on those bands. They made a lot of money and they were big, but it just didn't resonate with me as much as like, I was listening to like chill wave stuff. You know, that was more interesting. Like Neon Indian, who actually him and some other guy that he played with a lot used to come to my shows. They were like 19 years old or 18 back before they got big.
That was like the Ghost Hustler era.
Yeah, Ghost Hustler. Yeah. And then, they used to, I used to be friends with them, and they used to come to my shows when I was just beginning. Other Texas stuff, which is funny, just we're talking about Texas music. When I played in England, I told you this earlier, it was like English people love American music. Like, so I was basically regurgitating back their own music to them. I was taking Britpop and regurgitating it in an Americana way, in a Texas spin way. And then the second time I went back there, I would always bring belt buckles, Texas Lone Star belt buckles, because they love Dallas. They just love the TV show Dallas.
So many bands that I was big into here in the local scene that, you know, they kind of fill out trees.
Yeah.
And then you'd see pictures from their European tour. And I mean, the place was packed.
Packed. We could talk forever about the Dallas like music scene and how supportive or non-supportive the audiences are here, depending on who's coming through. At the time that I was playing, it was basically, I mean, there was an okay audience, but it was hard. Even big artists would come through town and they couldn't pack a venue. It was very odd. Like
Deep Ellum too, you have to realize by the time that you hit like 2010, so much had gone on there.
Yes.
And so,
well, I kind of also moved here. I moved here at an era that where the people that had been around longer than me, like early 2000s or late 90s, that was kind of a peak era in of Deep Ellum as well. So that was where all the big bands like Chomsky and all these bands.
Exactly. You had Baboon, you had Chomsky,
yes.
You had Hi-Fi Drowning. Yes. You could still go down there and see Tripping Daisy.
Yes. All those bands were in that area. And then I came like just a few years at the tail end, like when that was a done. And then I showed up and when there was a whole new thing happening, which was still, you know, was kind of just no one, it was already over. It was like I showed up when everything had finished in that era. But and you and I are kind of around the same age, but it's like we grew up in an era where it was like, I would say the pre-2000 or mid-2000s era, where it was like the classic go out and try to just play shows, get a record deal, and then you're good. But that era died. So it's like nowadays, and we were discussing this, it's like I didn't get into this business to become a TikTok star. And it's like, do I really have to do that kind of stuff? And that's what people are more into that than they are music.
And if you're somebody who's actually telling a story, you don't want to tell a 30-second song.
Yes.
You want to tell an album.
Correct. And that's sad that that's gone, but getting someone to buy your music is pointless. It's like getting someone to just listen to you is hard enough, you know? And I still, when I wrote my album, it's a concept album, and I wrote it as a concept album. But now I'm like, okay, I guess I'm just going to have to like put out songs every few months and, you know, try to promote them in a singles era type format. I mean, people are still putting out albums, but at the same time, it's like people don't digest them that way unless they're really already a hardcore fan, then they will digest an album. But your average listener doesn't listen to music.
They won't find you for the whole album.
No.
But if they become a fan, they'll play the whole album.
Yeah.
And we cannot play a whole album, but we can play one of your songs. So let's go ahead and kick into something right now.
Okay.
Well, I get the sense that it's not quite right when we're laying in bed and it's late at night and you say to me, baby, you were born to lose. Tried to get ahead with my head of wood, if I knock three times, I'm sure we're bound to see some money. So I found my place in society with a Mr. and Mrs. Luxury. Gotta wash my mouth just to say how do you do. Well, they had their cake and they ate it too, and their bellies ache, they light it off, cause they got money. But the simple simple coconut milk is what I miss. Let's go back in time, forget about the modern age, cause the girls these days are so hard to please, when all I want is to sleep in the trees and sing Return to Monkey. Monkey sing, monkey do, gorillas
I think it would be fun to discuss some of the stuff that inspires you right now. We've already discussed what made you what you are. Before we kick into that, let me just ask. Okay, so you said that you're a big Blur fan. You said you're a big Oasis fan.
Yep.
You said that you understand and respect Elvis. Who would you say is most inside you? I've got a silly little term. I call it my soul animal. It's a cross between your soul brother, who you just feel that kinship with, and your spirit animal, which is, you know, that thing that is shining out from you. Who is that inside you? Is there a specific artist?
Man, that's really tough. I could have a list of artists that I would say through different periods of my time influenced me to what I am now. It's like Erasure was a huge influence on me, like especially singing. In fact, more than any other singing artist, Andy Bell from Erasure probably influenced my singing voice. Huge influence. Obviously Beatles, but you know, no one cares. About the Beatles. You know, I love the Beatles. But,
it's
you know,
okay to say that. I mean,
you know, that was an influential time of me of getting into Britpop. That's what Oasis and Beatles got me into British music. And then I went down the path of every British band. It was like I become a nerd into...
You mentioned the Kinks before.
Yeah, I just go and I get into them for a year or two, and then I will stop listening to them forever. It's like I went through a Led Zeppelin phase, you know. It's like after in my 30s, I went through a Led Zeppelin phase, not like 15 like most people do. So, I went through a Bob Dylan phase. That's all I listened to.
I think you have to do that if you're going to be somebody who truly appreciates and wants to be part of and continue the craft. I think that you have to taste everything.
Yes.
And find your place in that world.
And I'd say the thing that's interesting now of where I am, it's like, and you might agree or disagree, but I find as I get older, it's like so much stuff. It's hard to get into. I still discover a lot of new things. Like for an example, I was like just recently in the last few years, I'd probably say in the last 10 years, the artist that I listened to more than anything else, I'd say Beach House was a huge band. I love her voice. And then somebody like Wiseblood, I was like, not only is she amazing, I was just like, fell in love with this girl. It was like, I saw her at Club Dada a few years ago. And that was like, I love hearing someone who not only writes great songs, has very similar influences that I love, sings amazingly, has her own voice, is gorgeous, and she's not some 16-year-old pop star. She's like, I think she's in her 30s or late 30s or something. But she's so gorgeous and she sings so beautifully and she performs perfectly live. Like, she's a great. If she had come out 20 years ago, she'd be a megastar. Like, Wiseblood should have been a megastar. She's in the wrong era.
Well, we were talking the other day, and you had kind of rattled off a good half dozen people just here locally that you currently love, like Motorcade.
And this is only recently because John Dufalo, who I've known for a long time, and we always bump into each other, just like you and I bump into each other every now and then. It's like He's been around.
It's hard not to bump into him.
I know. And it's like, you know, I met him when I first met Salim. And it was like, that's how I met John Dufalo.
When you have 40 different bands going at the same time.
Okay, so that's the point. Is John Dufalo is like a one-man, multi-band, great guy. And so it's like, what isn't John Dufalo working on?
Exactly.
And so that's... And someone hit me to Motorcade only because of my... I have another band that I do every now and then called Lometa, which had a short run for a couple years. And we still play every now and then. But... it was like, oh, they were like, oh, you should play with Motorcade because you guys kind of sound, you have the same, like, it's similar sounding. Like, my other band is not retro pop. It's like modern pop. It sounds more like Blur and Gorillaz and or MGMT. And so someone said, oh, check out this band Motorcade. And I go, oh, that's cool. So I went and listened to it. And I was like, oh, it's John Dufalo. Of course it's awesome. And it's so good. I was just like, oh.
Have you seen the stuff he's doing with his daughter?
Uh-uh.
Oh, it's just so adorable. Yeah. I love it.
But he's just, he's such a sweet guy, but he's so talented, and he really is a good musician. But, another band I just recently saw with the Scribner Brothers, they're pretty good. They're kind of doing the Americana thing, but in their own kind of different way. It's not typical Americana, so that's another band that I was really...
I know the name. I haven't seen them, though. I know.
They played up here in McKinney. They were on the State Fair stage, and I had seen them play, and I was like, oh, that's pretty good. I was impressed. And they were really sweet guys. Now McKinney's like a place you come see a festival, and there's like 50 million bands. They do the Texas Revolution.
The thing about McKinney is it seems like they are very proactively trying to have events on the square on the regular. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is there's constantly an event here. And I mean, you've even got, you know, Joshua Jones doing his country fest.
Yep.
There's always something in McKinney right now, which I like.
Yeah, and that Texas Music Revolution thing keeps getting bigger. And then it's funny because it's like all these bands that I'm friends with, they're walking down the street and I go, hey, and they're like, I haven't seen you forever. And I'm like, what are you doing? Oh, we're playing the Texas Music Revolution. So it's just, it's become a thing.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what's really interesting. And there was an article recently, too, about how the North DFW scene is becoming a thing. Like the Legacy Hall plays good shows. The scene is different, and it's not, I don't necessarily know if it's because we're old, but you know, that probably is a factor, but at the same time, there are some up and coming bands and things, but I just haven't seen, I don't know how you create a scene now, unless it's like, particularly because Deep Ellum doesn't exist in the same way that it did. So there's not a lot of venues. There are still some, but not the same.
It's like, yeah, you could be a regular at Three Links.
Yes.
I've seen some of the bands that know each other. They're doing what we did.
Yeah.
But you're right. It's not the same.
And I've gone to some shows recently, even at Dada and some other places, and it's not the same. And it's not, I don't necessarily think it's because of us. It's a different dynamic right now. I find out about the most obscure, bizarre bands from my 17-year-old than I ever would. But they don't have to go out to go discover that stuff. It's all just sitting there in chat rooms and memes and Discord channels, you know.
Yeah, we've got kids the same age, and one of them was getting tickets to a concert. I mean, from the sound of the name of the band, I was like, oh, they're probably playing like a Bomb Factory or something.
Yeah,
they were filling AAC. I mean, granted, it was a multi-bill. It was like three or four bands, but still, I was like, how have I not heard of this band if they're at AAC?
Yeah, yeah. But no, that's again coming back to, I don't know if it's because we're old, but. There's still new music that I discover that's obscure and weird, but it's not the same. I don't get the, other than like, I mean, I still like writing. Even writing music is hard. It's like, I'm just now getting back into writing music again. I'm like, oh, okay. I forgot because I've been putting that on pause for so long that now I'm coming back to it and going, oh yeah, this is what this was like. So it's really exciting to start that again and see where it goes. So yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Well, I think, let's circle back around because I think it's time to hear another song.
Yeah.
And you had mentioned earlier Motorcade.
Yeah.
What do you think about playing some Motorcade?
Yeah, let's hear a Motorcade song.
All right, perfect.
Your arms around me
right, so I don't know if our listeners can hear it, but I'm actually kind of in love with all the background noise that has been going on the entire time. I've walked on the street of downtown McKinney, and it's been nice. It's been pleasant, but it's amazing, you know, the cars and the horns and the trains.
Yep.
It's very city-like.
Yes. This is my fake urban living experience for the past 15 years. It's been a joy.
Having spent so much time in Deep Ellum, it feels Deep Ellum-ish to me.
It kind of is. I mean, McKinney was still kind of a quiet town, and then over the past 10, 15 years, it's just become, I mean, literally, and that's also because liquor laws changed, so now your bars can stay open until 2 a.m. down here and all those things. And we do open, you can open carry liquor anywhere in McKinney. So, but it changed, man. The nightlife has shifted down here to where every single night there's something going on. It's not like, it used to be just like a Saturday night or a Friday night.
And they're trying new things. Because I did, just at Filtered last Friday, I did a DJ gig there.
Yes.
And he was talking about what all the Celt normally does.
Yeah.
That same night, Red Zeppelin had a Taylor Swift dance party.
Yeah.
And I mean, so there's something for
everybody. Yeah, everybody. There's always something going on. And there's tons of bands that play down here all the time.
So and I saw a dude walking around busking.
Uh-huh. No, there's buskers like hardcore, and a lot of them are really good musicians. They're not
saw that a lot in Denton.
Yeah.
It made sense. I mean, you know, the college town and the square fit that.
Yes.
But I was surprised to see it here.
Yep. I am going to start playing again soon. I like playing. I've been stuck in McKinney for now for a long time, but it's time to get out of hibernation. And
but that's all right. You know a lot of people down here.
Yeah.
And I can imagine that if you were like, hey, I've got the itch to just play something live, you could walk in anywhere and they'd let you do it.
Yeah. Pretty much. Most of the venues that still exist in Dallas, I know still all the owners and stuff. So, and I've already talked about playing shows again with them. So they're pretty open to having me play.
What do you think McKinney has to offer past that?
Well, Red Zeppelin, I mean, being a small little record shop, it still puts on really good shows.
They've got that little stage. What all do they bring in?
Just all kinds of crazy, like, teenage punk bands. I found one that doesn't even have an online anything, and they had tons of fans.
Cool.
They had no social media presence. Like, a lot of teenagers are still into grunge. Kids are playing, like, Smiths records now. Like, tons of kids are into the Smiths. And half their culture comes from memes, so it's like whatever meme song is they're into. It's like, I remember a few years ago, what was the other song that got big? Big Iron, because of a meme. So like, Big Iron on his hip, like that became a popular song. And so like, how do you know that song? Oh, because of meme. And then my dad's like, how do you know that song? I'm like, because I love that music. But no, McKinney's cool, man. Like, one thing that I've seen in the last 5-6 years is I would go to these techno raves. And they're real, like, legit underground warehouse raves, like you would see back in the 90s. They're a little more dark and a little more industrial, matrixy style, but, like, the spirit's there kind of like how it used to be in the mid-90s.
That doesn't surprise me, because Dallas does actually have a pretty huge scene for that. I mean, think about the fact that Lights All Night is held here every year.
Yeah.
You know, huge EDM and house and techno festival. I mean, that could be held
Wands
anywhere.
Wands is an old school cat.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, Wands. he's been in that scene forever.
He's the encyclopedia for that.
Yeah. If you need to know anything about comics, Marvel, or EDM, or techno, talk to Wands.
I'll try to convince him to be on the show at some point.
I've known him for a long time. And we can get him on.
He's great. Well, let's go ahead and finish things up. I think we had some fun. It was definitely good sitting down with you for a while again. I know we've sat and talked inside Red Zeppelin before for, you know, 20, 30 minutes. I'll run into you here and there. But it was good to actually have a long sit down again.
Yeah,
so I really appreciate you doing this.
We could go longer, man. We could keep it going. I got plenty of side stories.
We could.
We could do it forever, but you know me. I can talk forever. But
let's finish out on another Texas band. Who do you think would be fun?
Well, like I mentioned, I'm playing at a wedding in a few days with the McClellan boys, and all the Mid-Lake dudes are going to be there. It's going to be a little party of all these bands. It's going to be
great.
All Texas guys. So let's close out with some Mid-Lake.
All right. Well, I appreciate you all for tuning in. We will be back next week. Thanks.
See ya.
If all the growth starts to fade, starts to falter, oh, let me inside, let me inside. Not to wake. Let that grows starts to fade, starts to falter. Oh, let me inside, let me inside, not to wait. Great are the signs.